we're now finishing our lecture on Sharia law. And as I mentioned, we did Rukhsa and Azima. These are just some terms which deal with the law, but really don't have any good place to place them in this little fiqh, so we just sort of stick it in the end. And this is the terms of Ada and Iada and Qada. Remember when we were discussing the obligatory, the wajib, and we said that the obligatory or the wajib can be categorized into three categories. Who can remember those categories? Time, person, and settlement. Okay, and in terms of person, in terms of time, it refers to as what are the two categories? Latitude, right? Which is al-wajib, al-muwassi', right? The tape for it, there, right? And then when there's a fixed time, it's called al-wajib, mudayyiq. Okay. So when you do an act of worship during its time, okay, it is called ada. When you do the act of worship within its time, So when the performance is within its time, it's called ada. When it is repeated, within its time, for some reason, I mean, it's repeated because it was not done correctly, it was not sahih initially when you did it, so it then therefore it's repeated, this is known as i'ada. And when the act of worship is done after its time, it is known as qada. Now, the qada would be when it's done after its time, because either it was done incorrectly initially, or because, for instance, one did not do that act of worship whatsoever. He fell asleep, right? He was working all day long, and he got home, fell asleep on the couch, and missed Maghrib prayer. Got up, and it was midnight. Okay, so his praying of al-Maghrib and Isha is now referred to as Qada. Okay? He's a new Muslim. He doesn't pray correctly. Still within the prayer time, so somebody sees him praying incorrectly, teaches him how to pray. His second praying is called Iada. And you do the prayer correctly within his time, for instance, it's called Ada. And that applies for any other act of worship which is linked to time. Yes? No, because when it's repeated within its time, it becomes i'ada. When the initial time, the initial, when it's, maybe I should put the initial, initial performance, okay, within its time, that's called ada. Maybe that makes the definition a little bit more distinct. Okay. All right, so with the conclusion of those three terms, upside down. All right. I must be getting old with this new technology and stuff like that. All right. So now we have completed this definition. All the constituent parts for Sharia law. Sharia law is a divine address that pertains to the acts of the morally obligated and consist of a demand, an option, or a declaration. Yes?
Is
But, you know, for, yeah, okay, go on. No, it does, because, for instance, you can take, like, the voluntary prayer. If it is your in your habits, your, if you are habitually praying witr prayer every single night, you know, throughout the year you pray your witr at the last of the night. And one day you get up late, so you don't just miss witr, you also overslept and you miss fajr, and it's sunrise. Well, we know that we have to pray fajr prayer. We have to make the qadha of fajr. Can one now make qadha of witr? Yes, according to the strongest opinion of the scholars. Yeah. It's described. It's described like that. I mean, it's described with that description. But basically, this pertains to the obligatory acts. I mean, some voluntary acts are described that way, yes. No. The qadha just means that you have done it, but it does not mean that you have received any reward, and you still might have entailed sin if there was no reason for you to have delayed it after its time. The only time a person receives the reward is that, as the hadith said, that if a person falls asleep or forgets, and then upon remembering or awakening does the prayer which he's missed, he receives his full reward if he does it at that, you know, time when he remembers or awakens. But this is provided that your falling asleep is not due to negligence on your part. I mean, you stay up all night long, right? Fall asleep a half an hour before fajr. That's not what it applies to. But it, you know, applies to that if just something happens. It's not something habitual. I mean, I mean, yes, I've seen people who've done that. I mean, even though not from a Pakistani family, but I mean, Muslims, I mean, sometimes do all their prayers at the end of the workday and so forth. That doesn't mean that they have not done anything which is sinful. The best they can hope for is that the obligation to do the prayer, right? That the prayer is, in other words, by them making up the prayer, doing it after its time, so the obligation before Allah to do the prayer has been fulfilled. That's the best they can hope for. Okay? But it doesn't mean they've received any reward for that prayer, and it doesn't mean that they have removed the sin for delaying the prayer and praying it after its time. Even though they know something. Right, I'm saying the best that they can hope for. I'm not saying that they definitely have removed that obligation before Allah. I'm saying the best that it can be. All right. So, I would imagine that somebody could tomorrow, when I'm in Scotland, right, write a paper, maybe a group of brothers, explaining the definition of Sharia law as an exercise. Those brothers who've been taking good notes could probably sit together, right, for a couple of hours and put a little handout, which can then be photocopied for their other brothers in the class, right, regarding Sharia law. Is that a strong enough hint, or do I need to assign a... But I think it's a good exercise that, you know, we've taken these notes now, right, so we should be able to put the definition of al-hukm al-shar'i, right, the Sharia law. And then we should be able to break down the constitution parts, talk about the lawgiver, talk about the acts of the morally obligated, what is taklif, and so forth. Talk about the demands, the four demands, the wajib, the mandub, the mubah, and the makruh, excuse me, and the haram. Talk about the option, the mubah. Talk about the different declarations, and all the different categories, and so forth, right? I'm sure 3-4 brothers who were taking good notes sat together, they could probably, over a day or two, you know, put something together. And that way, you'll have learned that topic well, which is the idea, I guess, of coming to the class. It's not a requirement, but I just think it's a good measure of how much we've learned. Okay. Now that we have finished in our course study, remember we said we'd have the introduction, and then we had the lawgiver, and now we just did the Sharia law. So we've done three parts, and now we're sort of like in the fourth part of our course, which are the sources of Sharia law. Or, if you, that's one way of looking at it, that's the way we're breaking in our course, but if we look at it in our definition, there's another way of looking at the issue, what we're going to be setting now, is that we're actually setting the address itself, right? The actual address. That's another way of imagining it. But for the way that I broke up the course, the heading is the sources of Sharia law, the fourth heading in our course. Or the actual address itself. Basically, the sources of Sharia law are many because the scholars differ concerning the validity of certain sources. What we're going to do for the purposes of this course is that we're going to discuss three sources where there is unanimity regarding its validity in its essence. Although some of the specifics of these sources, there is a difference of opinion regarding the validity of certain specifics. Those sources being the Quran, the Sunnah, and thirdly, the Ijma'. We will discuss Qiyas, which the majority of the scholars consider a source of law, but we will discuss that under the section of the interpretation. Of the law, which is the next section, okay, of law. The book which I'm using as a guide for teaching this course, the textbook that I'm using, discusses Qiyas in this section, so therefore I'm just following that the author's work. The sources of Sharia law that we were going to discuss, I said, are three, the Quran, the Sunnah, and the Ijma'. I think it'll probably take us about two lessons to finish all these three, or maybe three lessons. So we probably will just do the Quran, or maybe just part of the discussion regarding the Quran tonight. Okay, so let us start with the Quran. Regarding the Quran, there are a number of issues, legal issues, regarding Allah's book. Let's not forget, we're discussing the Quran now in a legal viewpoint. We are not discussing it from a theological standpoint, like whether is the Quran Allah's literal word or not, right? The Salaf, of course, the opinion of the people of the Sunnah, have it that the Quran is Allah's literal word. Some of the variant sects, look at the Quran as an expression of Allah's words and not being His literal words. We're not going to be discussing that matter. We are not discussing the Quran in terms of the specific regulations within the Quran. And for instance, what does this surah command or what does this surah prohibit? We're not looking at it like that. We're not looking at the Quran in terms of the adab, right, or the manners and the etiquette that one must have when dealing with the Quran. That's a different issue. What we're discussing is the Quran as a source of Sharia law. Okay, so this is the perspective we are studying the Quran by. And in that, there is a number of issues. First of all, they normally give a general definition to the Quran, being that the Quran, in a legalistic, as a source, if you want to define it, is Allah's literal speech, or words, you could say, sent down to the Prophet Muhammad which we worship Allah through its recitation and is conveyed to us by tawatur, which I'll explain in a moment. And is written in the Masahif. Okay, what does this definition include? It is Allah's literal words or literal speech sent down to the Prophet Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, which we worship Allah through the recitation of these words. It is conveyed to us by tawatur. When something is conveyed, it can be conveyed by two means. One is called tawatur. And one is called ahad. Tawatur means something which is conveyed by so many chains of transmission throughout its conveying, and that it ends with something dealing with the senses, and so therefore it precludes any possibility of any fault in transmission or any lie to have been transmitted. Yes. It written. Oh, Masahif. I don't blame you. I can hardly read. Masahif. Explain what that means. Okay, what does tawatur again refer to? Right, it means something which is conveyed in so many chains of transmission. All right, and it ends in something regarding the senses, okay, that it precludes any possibility of any error in transmission or that a lie was transmitted. So the Quran is mutawatir in its transmission to us in the sense that so many people transmitted from the Prophet Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. It ended in something which deals with the senses, which is actually what he spoke, right? Which was heard. That it precludes that what has been transmitted to us, has there is an error in the transmission, or that something fabricated against the Prophet Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, which he did not say was transmitted to us. Being what, in this case, being him saying that Allah revealed to me these words, these are Allah's words. Now, when something transmitted is not of the degree of tawatur, it's referred to as ahad. Okay. So in ahad, a lie could be transmitted, and also a fault in transmission, some error, something erroneous to be transmitted. Now, it's conveyed to us by tawatur and is written in the masahif. The masahif is the plural of the Arabic word mushaf, which I imagine most of us know. The mushaf is the actual Quran, right? The actual written Quran is called a mushaf. Masahif is the plural of that word. That's the definition of the Quran. Yes? Well, I mean, by I mean to prove it, I mean you would have to show a non-Muslim, right, that it was conveyed by so many chains of narration, which, unless I mean the non-Muslim was willing to sit with you and they are. But don't forget, the Quran was written, codified in a text, written text, very early after the Prophet ﷺ's death. And so therefore, the proof of its the issue of its tawatur, right, deals only with just those first few years until the time of Uthman, when he sent the five Masahid out to the different, or six, to the different provinces. Yes. I don't recollect such an incident. I mean, that doesn't preclude it having occurred, but I don't seem to recollect this incident, so it needs some investigation into it. There's no number. Some people say 40, some people say 10, but there's really no number. It's whenever something occurs and it's transmitted with such frequency that it precludes any lie being having been originated and being transmitted, or something be translated erroneously, and it ends with something that deals with one of the senses. In other words, something was touched, heard, smelt, seen, tasted. Huh? No, it's higher. Yeah, it's the highest possibility of transmission of knowledge is by tawatur. Remember when we said that knowledge was two types? What were the two types of knowledge? Huh? Right. Necessary knowledge, right? And acquired knowledge. Acquired knowledge is something which you have to establish the proof for in order to show its soundness. Necessary knowledge is something which is determined by the senses, right? In the sense that you see something, you don't need a proof for its establishment, right? You have to do some sort of rational argument to prove it. You taste something, you touch it, you smell it, okay? And likewise, when something is conveyed to you by tawatur, all right, it is from the necessary knowledge. It doesn't need a proof and evidence to show its soundness or its validity or its reality. No. So let's just try to stick to the topic anyway. So, you know, the point is that the Quran is transmitted to us as tawatur. Okay. Now, let us, the next point we want to discuss. All right. There are certain recitations of the Quran which are conveyed to us not in tawatur, but which are ahad narrations. Ahad narrations. In other words, they are not in agreement with the Mus'haf, some of these narrations. or excuse me, not narrations, but recitations. Let us, first of all, let us mention what are the conditions for a sound recitation of the Quran. Well, in order for a recitation of the Quran to be sound, it must have fulfilled these conditions. It must be in agreement with the text of Uthman's Mus'haf. Two, it must agree with the Arabic language. Three, it must be conveyed with a sound chain to its narrator, or reciter in this case, reciter, let's just, so we can try to use the terms as different from the hadith. Its reciter. Okay? And some people add a fourth condition, that it must be conveyed in Tawatur. Okay. So, a recitation, the initial Mus'haf written by Uthman had no diacritical marks, none of these fathas and kasras and dhammas, right? And had no dots upon it. And let me give you an example. A couple of days ago during Salat al-Maghrib, I don't know if anybody noticed, but the Imam who was reciting the Quran was not reciting according to the narration or the recitation which I just led in Salat al-Maghrib. He was reciting according to the recitation of Warsh upon Nafir. And one of the differences is that they do not say Maliki Yawm al-Din, but they say Maliki Yawm al-Din. Malik, which is the narration, recitation which most of you probably have memorized and which I used when I was leading Salah. Malik is written in standard Arabic now like this, and it means owner. And Malik is written like this, and it means king. Okay? Both recitations are confirmed upon the Prophet ﷺ. He recited Surah Al-Fatiha in both ways. Sometimes reciting it Maliki Yawm al-Din, which means the owner of the Day of Judgment, and other times reciting it as Maliki Yawm al-Din, meaning the King of the Day of Judgment. Now, the Mus'haf written by Uthman was written in the Arabic style that when looking at the word, you can read in it both Maliki and Maliki. How? Because in classical Arabic, they would not write the alif for the word. Okay, that's why if you open up your Quran now, you'll see it written like this. Okay, and you'll see a small alif written between the meem and the lam to indicate to you that since this Quran is written according to the recitation of Hafs upon Asim, to recite it as Maliki. But if you bought a Quran written in Morocco, or printed in Morocco, right, because they don't normally write Qurans by hand anymore, okay, it will not have that small alif over there, because it's written according to the recitation of Warsh upon Nafir, which is the recitation of the people of Medina, and the recitation which most of us use, the recitation of people of Kufa. Now, the point is that there are a lot of other words, okay, in the Arabic language, which the writing of the Mus'haf of Uthman allows for that. One is, just to try to think of some examples, is in Surah Al-Kahf, Remember, as I said, in most halves of Earth man, there were no dots, okay, like before or after a letter. So let us put this word, okay, I'm going to put the dots for Sheen, okay, Yushrik, right? You can read this Yushrik or Tushrik, okay, means no one is, so the verse says, and no one is associated, وَلَا يُشْرِكْ فِي حُكْمِهِ أَحَدًا. The verse in Surah Al-Kahf says, and none is associated in his judgment. Okay? According to the recitation of Hafs upon Asim, which we recite in Surah Al-Kahf, and none is associated in his judgment. It's an information that nobody judges with Allah. Another recitation, I think it's the recitation of Ibn Kathir, but I'm not certain, recitation of people of Damascus, has it recited as, when he would is recited as Tushrik, do not associate anybody, as an order, okay, a command in the judgment of Allah. Now, the Mus'haf of Uthman, having no doubts, dots to it, right, allows you to read it in both ways. Okay, and many other examples for the different recitations. Yes? Doesn't the same rule apply to what both means? No, one is an information by Allah that none associates with him in his judgment. He's informing that there is no other power that associates with him in what he judges and decrees. And one is a commandment to you human beings. Do not associate anybody in his judgment. Do not judge to another law, for instance. Yes. He will both. Because the hadith of the Prophet ﷺ said the Quran was revealed upon seven letters. Seven ahruf. Seven, you know. Yes. Yeah, and that's why when you come to my tafsir class in Washington, D.C., sometimes I indulge the brothers by saying, according to one recitation, it means this, and your translation would then should say this, and according to another translation, meaning recitation would mean this, and your translation should say such. No, no. In fact, what it does, the numerous recitations add more meaning to the Quran, and so therefore, no, it makes the meanings more stronger. I mean, it adds to the beauty of the Quran, and this is a point. It shows us, you know, the sadness of us living in these later generations, where, you know, earlier when people used to memorize, scholars would have memorized the various recitations and so forth. It would add a beauty to the Quran, but now you can hardly find a person who memorized the Quran at all, you know, according to one recitation, let alone memorize it according to multiple recitations and know its explanation and so forth. No, in the Mus'haf of Uthman, it was written like this. No, it was written in a way so for Ya and Ta, because these dots were only introduced much later. And just like the Dhamma and the Kasra and the Fetha were introduced later, only when people lost the Arabic language. And as a result, when it was written like this, in that case, you could read it as a ya or a ta. But what happens if somebody tried to read it as a ba or a na? A noon, you know? That would make a problem in the meaning. So when people, because they didn't know Arabic, a lot of non-Arabs entered into Islam, and the time from the Prophet's period of his lifetime passed, and so even the Arabs themselves were not, they said, well, let's, you know, put these dots, make sure people don't start going, you know, away from the correct recitation by reading it incorrectly. So let's continue with our conditions, okay? So therefore, a recitation must agree, be in agreement with the text of Uthman's Mus'haf. It must be in agreement with the Arabic language. In other words, it cannot have something which grammatically is incorrect. It must be conveyed with a sound chain to its reciter. In other words, if somebody says that Ali ibn Abi Talib, or Ibn Mas'ud, or Ibn Abbas, or one of the Prophet's companions, heard the Prophet recite the Quran in this manner, that must be correctly conveyed, okay? And the fourth condition is that it must be conveyed in tawatur. Okay? And so therefore, of the numerous recitations of the Quran, the seven recitations have nothing to do with the seven letters, okay? Don't get that confused. Seven recitations fit the definition of the Quran. All right? And of those seven recitations, some scholars add three more, so it gives us a total of 10 recitations. And each of these seven narrators have two narrators upon them. So in another sense, 7 times 2 equals 14. So for instance, what we recite now, if you look at the back of your Quran, we recite it upon Hafs, upon Asim. Asim is one of the seven reciters of the Quran. And we recited Hafs upon Asim. The people of North Africa recited from Warsh upon Nafir. And Nafir was in Medina, and Asim was in the city of Kufa. And Asim's recitation goes back to Ali ibn Abi Talib, for instance, and some of the other companions of, it's mentioned back in the Mus'haf. Yes. In fact, who has a Mus'haf? Let me just read. I want an Arabic Mus'haf, not one of these translations, which might not happen. Does it have the... No. No, I mean an Arabic Quran. Yeah. Because it's in the back of it, just to recite it for the brothers so we can... Okay? It says right here, after Surah An-Nas, it says that this Mus'haf was written, and also the Dhabt, the diacritical, markings of like the Dhamma and the Kasra, according to what agrees with the narration of Hafs bin Sulaiman upon Hafs bin Sulaiman bin al-Mughira al-Asadi. Asad is his tribe, okay? Hafs is his name, Sulaiman is his father's name, Mughira is his grandfather's name. Al-Kufi, from the city of Kufa, upon Asim ibn Abi Najud al-Kufi, who is a tabi'i, okay? Who took it from Abi Abdurrahman Abdullah bin Habib al-Sulami, who took it from Uthman ibn Affan, Ali ibn Abi Talib, Zayd ibn Thabit, Ubay ibn Ka'ab, upon the Prophet ﷺ. So that is the senate of our recitation, okay? Now, as far as its writing of the letters, it was taken from, it says, okay, what the ulama of the writing of the Quran took from those masahif which the Khalifa Uthman ibn Affan sent to the cities of Basra, Kufa, Sham, and Mecca. So here's the agreement with the text of Uthman's mushaf, and the one that he left for the people of Medina, and the one which he left for himself. And those masahif copied from those. Okay? And in particular, according to what was written by the two sheikhs, Abu Amr Dani and Abu Dawood Sulaiman bin Najah, and choosing the second way of writing upon the first when there's a difference. Okay. And so then therefore it talks about, for instance, as in terms of diacritical marks, it was taken from the marks invented by Khalil bin Ahmed and his followers, instead of the marks of the Eastern Muslims, instead of the marks written by the Spanish Muslims, the Andalusian, and the Maghariba. And then it tells about the numbering of the verses. It was taken from the numbering of the people of Kufa, according to, as numbered by Abu Abdurrahman Abdullah bin Habib al-Sulami, who took it from Ali ibn Abi Talib, and so forth. And then also, about the where you stop in the recitation and so forth, it was taken from Ash-Shatibi. So this is how the Mus'haf is put together. Before that, about the marks, for instance, like in the Eastern way, the Eastern Muslims, we write the letter Qaf with two dots on top, and we write Fa with one dot, right? The Spanish Muslims and Andalusian, before when they used to exist, right? And the Maghariba, They write fell with one dot, but they write cough with a dot on the bottom. Okay. Yes. In terms of the Quran, yeah, it is said that there is a copy of the original Quran written by Uthman, one extant now in the Soviet Union, and that's what somebody told me when I was here, but I haven't come across that myself. I mean, I haven't read the article myself. And then later on in Russia, and that's because it was in the city of Bukhara, and when the armies of the Tsar took Bukhara about 100 and or maybe 20 or 30 years ago, they took it with them to their, museum or whatever in Moscow. And one of the, if you look at one of the military agreements or military, it was like some between the Russians and the Ottoman Turks, there was some sort of stipulation that they would not touch or tamper the Mus'haf of Uthman. It was one of the peace treaties or accords between the two countries. But there's also some Masahif, which are written, not the original Mus'haf written by Uthman, but there are some Masahif written, copied from that original Mus'haf, which are still extant in Yemen and elsewhere. No. Yeah, and well, there's a very funny story that one scholar from Mali, a great scholar, reading according to the recitation of Warsh, he led a salah in a Bedouin hamlet in Arabia, and he read it according to his recitation, which is the recitation of Warsh upon Nafir. So after Salah, the Bedouins were very angry. Who is this guy reciting the Quran in a sort of a funny way? And so they were angry at him, and he said, this is the recitation, telling them this is the recitation of Nafir. And so Nafir means that which is useful. And so the Bedouins replied to him, La Nafir Allahu Lak, may Allah bring no use of you. So it can happen. And also, in the hadith of the Prophet ﷺ, Bukhari, one time one of the companions recited Surah Al-Furqan according to a recitation which the Prophet taught him, and Umar had not known that recitation, and so Umar dragged him to the Prophet ﷺ for tampering with the Quran. The Prophet ﷺ told Umar to recite, and he said, both of you have done well, because he taught them both to recite that surah in that way. Okay, so, but we want to get to the matter of Usul al-Fiqh, brothers. So it must be in agreement with the text of Uthman's Mus'haf. It's agreement with the text of Uthman's Mus'haf. It must be in agreement with the Arabic language, the grammar, right? It must be conveyed with a sound chain to its reciter, as we saw in our chain to the four companions, right? And it must be conveyed mutawatir, which is conveyed by so many chains that it precludes any possibility of a lie or an error in transmission. So what happens if this condition is not there? It is not part of the Quran. But then does that recitation become a source of legal law? Can we use it then? And this is a difference of opinion between the Usuliyyin. Okay, so we have a recitation of the Quran, which is not conveyed to us by tawatur. Can we then use it to bring some sort of additional information, additional legal point? Some of the recitations of Ibn Mas'ud. Can we use this now to confirm a new legal law? There's a difference of opinion between the scholars regarding that. And let me have an example, which I think I can provide. I hope it's in this book. Okay. If you look at Nisa, Surah Nisa, verse 40. Surah Nisa, verse 40, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala mentions that he has a brother and a sister. We have 5 minutes, okay. Somebody, let's look at the English translation. It's not number 40, it's number 12. Okay, so the translation given in this translation, if the man or a woman whose inheritance is in question has left neither ascendants or descendants, meaning neither forefathers or children, but has left a brother or a sister. So the verse says, has left a brother or a sister, according to the recitation by Sa'ad ibn Abi Waqas. He recited the verse, has left a brother or a sister from the mother. So, a brother or a sister, Surah 4, verse 12. Sa'ad ibn Abi Waqqas had this addition to it from the mother. من الأم. And so therefore, some scholars will not accept this as a legal proof because it doesn't fit the condition of Tawatur. All right? This was just a single recitation. It was not conveyed to us by such a Tawatur. All right? And however, though, another group of scholars will consider this to be, even though not part of the Quran, to be a legal proof, and so therefore it would add an additional meaning to that. So it adds an additional meaning to that. All right. Those who do not, they say that it's not part of the Quran because one of the conditions for the Quran is that it has to be in agreement with the text of Uthman's Mus'haf and it has to be conveyed to us in Tawatur. This time, min al-um, these additional words, is not in agreement with the text of Uthman's Mus'haf, nor for us it was it conveyed in Tawatur. They say it's part of the revelation, but they say we cannot include part of the Quran because it doesn't fit the conditions of the Mus'haf itself. No, it's not. The other scholars say that perhaps this was a tafsir by the companions. And so therefore it's not a legal proof. That they were just explaining the meaning of the verse. Yeah, there's another, but I was trying to find the passage number, the verse. When it says that you should fast 6 days, Ibn Mas'ud, in his recitation, had the word, he used to recite it, mutatabi'at, which means consecutively. So therefore, it would add the condition that if you were to say it's a proof, that when a person fasts 6 days, he must do it in consecutive order, as opposed to the other opinion, which would say that you could do it either consecutively or not. I think I'll try to look at the actual verse number to provide it for you. We're going to have to, huh? Which is the stronger? I mean, I don't, I'm not in the position to say which is the stronger of the two. Just to know that there are two arguments, and so therefore, some scholars would add legal judgments based upon those recitations which are ahad, okay? And one might then therefore add another legal judgment. Jazakallah khair. Time for salah. So inshallah, I'll see you all, I guess, on Sunday, right? Or Saturday, right? Subhanakallah.